at the Lord's table together. And so after next week, as promised, I'll begin an introduction to the wonderful address. It's not even a letter. The wonderful address by Koheleth, the great preacher of Ecclesiastes. And we're just going to do introduction, not next week, but the week after. We're going to do interesting and I hope thought-provoking introduction to that letter. Next week, again, we'll be at the Lord's table and enjoying that fellowship. This week, today, I'm going to finish what I started last Sunday, which was something like a New Year's reflection. I didn't finish it last week. There's some news, huh? I didn't finish it in 1 week. But we'll finish it this week. And it's going to end up in Psalm 90, where we've been, probably as many of you as have been here at Grace have known that my habit has been at the first of the year to go to Psalm 90 and think about Psalm 90. But let me make those connections with last week. Of course, what we did primarily last week was read from Genesis chapter 1 and 2 in an effort to sort of account and recount the way and the reasons for why things are the way they are and how they got that way and were things ever different than what we know now to be the case in life in general, in the broad scope of what we experience, what we know to be true, what history teaches us one generation is like to another generation. So Genesis, and I would say again to catch last week's, the thrust of what I was doing there, is that Genesis presents to us a story, and by using the term story, I don't mean fictitious or mythological. I just mean in story-ish form. Genesis and much of the other history of the Bible presents to us a story of the way things are. And I think God communicates to us specifically that way because everybody knows that kids like a story, right? Children love a good story. And often the profoundest truths come to us in the form of story, and we remember them better in the form of story, which is why much of the Old Testament history is written down for us in the form of story, in the form of poetry, in the form of narrative, some history. But there are lovely ways that God himself has chosen by design, by the consistency of his own character to communicate to us in a way that we understand and that we remember and that we're drawn into the story. There are many competing stories in the world in which we live to account for the way things are and how they got this way. Or have they ever been like this forever? In the Bible, the Bible's story I take to be absolutely true as an accounting of why things are the way they are, and was it ever different? Were there ever other intentions than what we know, as little as that is, of life today? And really what I want to do and what I want to do last week, what I want to finish up this week, is to get you into a New Year's reflection mode. Everybody's sort of in that anyway. New Year's promises all the things for the new year that we didn't have last year, right? Resolutions. How many of you are making resolutions? Anybody? All right, some of you I'm not going to ask what those are, even though you put your hand up. But maybe if you're so jaded and cynical, you don't want to make the resolution because you know you'll break it. Hope springs eternal in the heart, doesn't it? So even if you're not making resolutions, you think, man, this is the time to get on the bandwagon. You've just come through the Christmas holidays and the New Year holidays where most of us eat things that we don't normally eat and a whole lot more of it than we should. And so we come off of all that stuff being around and we're thinking about our health and our weight and blah, 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 all that stuff. And that seems to fit well with New Year's. But what really sort of sparks all that is the fact that, you know, the calendar's been turned. The old measure of a year has been tossed out unless it's got really cool pictures on it. And so then what you do is you cut those out and put them in frames and then give them to people next year for Christmas, right, from the calendar. And you forget that they're the ones that gave you the calendar, so they're wondering why you're giving them a cut-up piece of it back the next year. But anyway, that's a great way to save money. And to be creative. Everybody loves a created present much more than those old store-bought things. But in any event, we toss the calendar away, and it's the end of a year. If you're somebody like me or other people, you write stuff on the days of the calendar. As you move through the year, you note things, and you pay attention to significant portions of the year. And when you pitch it or do whatever you do with it, it's a measure. It's a measure of the finite number of days that you have. And maybe the kind of thing we don't like to be reminded of that much. But anyway, provoking some New Year's reflection, sort of capitalizing on the fact that we think this way anyway, and one of those sort of unusual times in our life where the ebb and flow of time and how our lives have gone, we seem to be more or most prone, I suppose, to give a little harder reflection on our lives than we typically do. Maybe we might even ask ourselves the truly weighty questions which are normally avoided by us and easily avoided in the busyness and the hubbub of our lives. Often we like to avoid the weighty questions because the answers to those questions are either unbearable or we get glib pat answers that don't really satisfy what the weighty questions are asking. Glib pat answers are the last refuge of the thoughtless and the uncaring. And we don't want to be that, right? And we need to remind ourselves, and the scripture is very, very blunt to do this, that the Bible and the God that the Bible reveals to us is unabashed and relentless in pressing upon us these sorts of weighty issues, these ultimate life issues, these reflections on the passage of time, which is for us a reflection on our mortality, right? That's really what it kind of drips down to. That's sort of the essence of what we do with time and how we react to time. Men like Koheleth, who is otherwise known as the preacher in Ecclesiastes, sort of anxiously entertain these kinds of questions. If you've ever read Ecclesiastes, who's read Ecclesiastes? Raise your hand if you can. Okay, that's good. Who's read it in the last month? Put your hand down. Who's read it in the last hour? All right. So you know who Koheleth is, and he is thought to be by most, except for the highly critical, to be Solomon. And writing a very unique style of wisdom literature. And it's very blunt, it's very raw in the issues that it addresses. It's not an attempt to sugarcoat anything about life and the experiences of life. And in fact, if you just read Ecclesiastes, it would be a pretty depressing book if you read it all the time and left it sort of unresolved in connection to the New Testament. But listen to a couple of these questions that come to the forefront of Solomon's mind when he moves through this. And I'm going to read from the NIV. Just because the questions are a little bit more obvious in the way they're stated here as opposed to some other translations. So Solomon writes right at the beginning of this letter or this narrative in verse 3 of chapter 1. I don't know if you've ever asked yourself these questions. Think about it. Think about this. Have you ever said to yourself, what does man or what do I gain from all my labor at which I toil under the sun? And I suppose there's as many things that we do in this room as there are people. Have you ever really thought about what the purpose of what you are doing is? What are you gaining by it? Even what appears to be the most useful or most interesting sorts of things that we can do these days, when you really start to think about them and think about whether or not your work is going to outlast you, or whether it's going to matter beyond you, or whether it's going to matter at all, the weight of that question really begins to grow. And it begins to grow, and the question begins to get heavier because, as Solomon points out here, it's kind of hard to tell if we're even any different than the animals. Because in the end, and Solomon says God tests us this way. Because in the end, we're roadkill just like they are. To use a blunt analogy, right? And Solomon says, who knows if the spirit of a man goes that way and the spirit of an animal goes that way? Who knows if what an animal is stays in the ground and a man, whatever a man is, goes anywhere else? Who knows? You don't know by observation, right? And so many cultures and civilizations recounting of the way the world is takes into consideration the immortality of man, the soul of man, and invents many myths and stories to account for what happens in death and where does that person go and the body and all the kinds of things and what happens when the one thing is separated from the other and what happens with this, what Ecclesiastes calls the inbred setting of eternity, which is in every man's heart, but in such a way that men are unable to really interpret that sense of eternity in the heart. What happens to all of that? And what does that mean for my labor under the sun? What does that mean for what I choose to do or what I am able to do? What falls into my lap or what options are given to me to spend the limited moments of my life in the way that I spend them? And in the end, who gives a rip? What difference does it make? I see some of you smiling at me, but this is the kind of question that destroys people. And it will destroy you if you don't have a good answer for it. And Solomon, one of the things he hated the worst was thinking about the fact that he might labor his whole life with skill and wisdom and build and do and accomplish only to leave it to a fool who will not acknowledge at all what it took to produce and achieve this and will have no knowledge of the person or the people or the generations or the families that produced these things. And Solomon said, I don't know of anything more bitter than that. And it brought him to a point of saying that he actually hated life. So what does a man gain from all of his labor? What are you going to gain this year for doing for another year what you did last year? You career men and women, your choice of a career, why'd you pick it? Why are you pursuing it? What do you plan to do through your career and do with your career? What difference does it make? And I'm not saying positive or negative. I'm not condemning or not. I'm not promoting. I'm just asking that question in the light of these ultimate sorts of issues and in light of the fact that one thing we know is sure, you're going the same place the animals go. And apart from God changing us in the twinkling of an eye, you're going to turn to dust. You came from dust, and to dust you're going to return. And Job said you didn't bring anything in this life, and you ain't taking anything out, right? Now, as a side note, I had to throw this in there. You can send some things on ahead. You wouldn't learn that from Ecclesiastes, but we do know from the story there is a way of translating temporal things from this life into eternal things that will outlast us and greet us. And that's amazing. But from the perspective of Ecclesiastes, I don't know, what good is it? Solomon says in chapter 2, I thought in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. There's a question for you. What is good? You ever thought about that? Who determines what is good? Who says what is good? Where does the sense of goodness come from? A sense of right and wrong. Well, our story tells us, doesn't it? The story has been laid out for us. We know the origin of good. But Solomon is asking himself, in the experience of men, in the pursuit of pleasure, achievement, accomplishment, the intellectual life, the life driven by desire and pleasure, by achievements, accomplishments, possessions, what is good? And Solomon said, I'm going to test myself with pleasure to find out what is good, but that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is foolish. You ever thought about laughing? Even the whole mechanism of laughing and what generates laughter? Solomon kind of thought, that's just foolish. It's foolish when you stop to think about it on its own. What does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see, and here's a question, I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. What's worthwhile to do? What is worth you spending the relatively few days you have that you know you have in comparison to, say, eternity? What's worthwhile your time and your energy, the strength of your arms and your legs and the labor of your mind and your heart and the giving and withholding of your affections and your desires? What is worthwhile? That is not as easy a question to answer as you think it is. I love some of the answers that Solomon actually does give. In chapter 3, verse 9, again Solomon says, what does the worker gain from his toil? I have seen the burden God has laid on men. He has made everything beautiful in its time. That is, God has. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. Generation comes and a generation goes, and a whole generation will forget about a previous generation. And all the luminaries, all the men and women who seem to have profile and reputation in our own day and age, a decade or less will obscure most of them, right? History records some things for us to remember. Think of all the people who have lived and all the people who have worked and toiled and achieved and made accomplishments, and most of them are completely unknown to us. When Solomon summarizes this section, he says in the last part of chapter 6, who knows what is good for a man in life during the few and meaningless days he passes through like a shadow? Who can tell him what will happen under the sun after he's gone? Who can tell him what will happen under the sun after he's gone? Nobody. Because you don't talk to anybody in the grave, right? And you and I don't really know what's coming ahead for us in the next few minutes. Some of you are hoping that I'll conclude quicker than I probably will. But you don't know it'll happen. Chances are it won't. That's just a joke. These questions, and there's a bunch more in Ecclesiastes that we'll get to in time, these are questions whose answers I would say to you either do one of three things. They either elude us, they depress us, or they harden us. They leave us either dazed and confused, to quote that famous 60s rock and roll band. The answers to these questions either leave us dazed and confused, sad, or mad, maybe all three at the same time. But they are weighty questions, and they are the stuff of midlife crises in our own culture. We have delineated a category and a set of reactions in our culture in response to these kinds of questions. We have a TV show now. Let me see if I can remember the name of it. What's that show about those three men? No, but that's a favorite. That's a favorite show of mine. Don't get me thinking about that in the pulpit. It's just not a profitable thing. What's the show? What? No, it's not Three and a Half Men. That's Two and a Half Men. This is about those three guys who are in midlife crises. Raymond, the guy who's on Raymond. Everybody loves Raymond. Yeah, is that it? Yeah, Men of a Certain Age. I can't remember it because I don't really watch it much, but when I was watching the trailers for it last season or whenever it came on, you know, probably 30 years ago, I would have laughed and thought, that's going to be the cheesiest show I've probably, and maybe it is, I don't know. But they really struck a chord with a certain group of people because guys watching that show, no matter how much it's caricaturized, are going to immediately identify with some of the ways those guys are thinking and what they're doing in life. They're men of a certain age, and it's time for a change. You know, you've lived this way for however many years, you start to think about it, and you think, what in the world am I doing? What am I doing? I'm halfway through my life. If I get the whole schmear, and I've wasted more than half, or a little less than half of it, doing this, or with this man, or with this woman, in the case of the guys. But we have our culture is embraced this notion of meaninglessness and shifting at some point, legitimately shifting to something that seems to us to be truer to ourselves and truer to what we really want and really desire. Who cares about the consequences? So what is worthwhile for men to do under heaven during the few days of their meaningless lives? And you know what's interesting about these questions? We as men are incapable of answering the question truthfully or accurately. We can't even answer the question. In fact, we are even incapable of ourselves of realizing that we are incapable of answering the question. Did you get that? We're incapable of realizing we're incapable of answering those questions. We need God to tell us that. Otherwise, men spin off, as we have in the history of men, we spin off 1,000 different ways to try and answer these questions. And living in the world that we do today, which is very relativistic in some ways, very self-centered, sort of narcissistic in a lot of those other interesting philosophical words, we don't often get the answer right. And it even takes God to tell us that we can't get it right apart from something outside of ourselves and our own wisdom and our own reason informing us of what is worthwhile and what is good in life to pursue. Now, well, no, that's another rabbit trail. We won't chase that. Solomon did tell us in Ecclesiastes 3 that we have this sense of eternity in your heart, but we don't really know how to interpret it. We don't really know how to extend it out on either end of our life, on either end of our generation, and we certainly don't have the ability to take the scope of history from the beginning to the end and really know how it specifically started for all the reasons that it started and how it's going to end up. And we certainly don't know how to narrow it down, even to our own generation, even to our own lives, our own narrow lives, and see well and accurately and purely truthfully how it fits and what is to be pursued as good and worthwhile even in our own lifetime. And the options for what to pursue in our own lifetime are multiplied many times over from just one or two generations back. It's quite an amazing time that we live in. Ecclesiastes is more relevant and more needed now than probably it ever has been. And people are probably more depressed because they are still getting poor answers. Even Christians are getting poor answers to those questions. And it leaves us empty-handed and heartbroken at the end of the day. We're dependent on God for revealing the nature, the true nature of things as they are and as they will be to us. So I guess at this point would be a good time to turn to Psalm 90, and let's listen to Solomon again in Psalm 90. It's the only psalm that we have on record that he is said to have authored. He speaks to us of the true nature of life's realities, which most of us are not really strangers to. Moses speaks to us from the survey of his own life in his ministry of leading the nation of Israel to the place that God had promised that he would take them. The realities of life are surveyed in the context of a long life lived coram Deo, to use the Latin phrase, a life that is lived before God. And Moses lived his life before God. His life was neatly divided into three segments, right, of 40 years. We have those 40 years in Egypt and all that took place there. We have 40 years of him being on what is called the backside of the desert, or his wilderness experience, or however you want to characterize that. Then the last 40 years of his life, it took that long to get him ready. So take heart, folks. 80 years old, he really embarked, in a very real sense, on the thing for which God had created him. And he is surveying, in Psalm 90, the long stretch of those years back, I'm sure, for his early days in the Egyptian courts, the privileges that he enjoyed, his identifying eventually with the people of God, all of the difficulties that he faced in those last 40 years of his life, events which happened during that time, which eventually led to his death, eventually led to him being put to death by God himself. Moses is surveying. So we give a little attention to this psalm, and I guess I'll take the time now, because I probably won't if I don't do it now, to just read through it again, straight through, and let our minds soak it in. And think again, you have to think who is writing this psalm. And this psalm was written directly connected to events in the life of Moses and in the life of the nation. We don't know exactly what they are, but we probably could put our finger on almost any area or any position on the timeline of Israel's history and find some similarity to what Moses is alluding to here. Because as you and I know, Israel, though it was a chosen nation of God informed by his miraculous power, was generally and basically an unfaithful people, right? You with me on that? The later prophets, the minor prophets, roundly called Israel a harlot. All those years, even leading up to the journey to the promised land, the psalmist said on occasion, "Were you offering all those sacrifices to me?" God uses the psalmist to say. And even while they were in the desert coming to the place of promise, God says, "No, you were offering up sacrifices to Molech and Rephidim and some of the other gods that you carried out of Egypt," even then, early in their history and throughout their entire history. The repetitious nature of their idolatry and their harlotry, their spiritual harlotry, is on record for all to read. And God's faithfulness is on display through all of that to read. And Moses knew that and, of course, was intimately connected with the history of Israel. So let's read. "Lord, you have," and obviously Lord is Yahweh here, "you have been our dwelling place in all generations, before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You turn man to destruction and say, 'Return, O children of men, for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past, and like a watch in the night, you carry them away like a flood.'" You ever seen a flood in operation? Whatever it's in its path is going. It is going to move. This is a flood, to connect to an analogy I mentioned to you several months ago, The world is full of analogies of divinity. God has built the world that way, and here's one he gives for us. Every time you see a flood and the destruction that that flood wreaks, you should think of God. And you should think of the analogy of the power of God. God sweeps away. When he raises his hand, no man puts his hand down. When he decides to do something, he does it and he carries it out, and no man frustrates that purpose. What he has made crooked remains crooked. What he straightens remains straight. That made Moses afraid. Moses knew that. In spite of all the mercy that Moses had at the hand of God, eventually God killed him on the mountain for his sin. You sleep them, you carry them away like a flood. They are like a sleep. In the morning, they are like grass which grows up. In the morning, it's all green. It flourishes. It grows up. In the evening, it is cut down and withers. For we have been consumed by your anger, and by your wrath we are terrified. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your countenance. For all our days have passed away in your wrath, and we finish our years like a sigh. This is Solomon. This is Solomon's observation. This is Moses' observation. The days of our lives are 70 years, and if by reason of strength they are 80 years, yet their boast is only labor and sorrow. It is soon cut off, and we fly away. And who knows the power of your anger? There's a question to ask yourself. Who knows the power of your anger? For as the fear of you, so is your wrath. So teach us to number your days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. And now here's where the really important feature of this psalm is given for our edification, and we need to pay close attention to this. Return, O Yahweh. Come back to your people. Turn your face back towards us. Don't remain with your back to us. How long? Have compassion on your servants. Oh, satisfy us early with your mercy, that we may rejoice and be glad in all our days. Make us glad according to the days in which you have afflicted us, the years in which we have seen evil. Let your work appear to your servants and your glory to their children, and let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish the work of our hands for us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. This is such a rich psalm. And it really, if we heed this, make the same sorts of solicitations that Moses is instructing us in now, we will be able to give at least a partially good answer, and at least can be assured that the track and trajectory of our lives, as they are defined by these latter solicitations in Psalm 90, are consistent with what God wanted to do all along. And though we may not always be able to see, realize in our own lifetime all of these things that he's talked about, the bulk of them can be known, pursued, and embraced in our own lives, even this day. And the good thing is that what God gives in these solicitations outlasts us. And God will see to that, but there's only a certain way that he will see to that. And the first thing I want to say in this psalm, the first observation I want to make with you, is how this thing starts off. Very first word. What is it? Very first word in that psalm. What is it? What is it? Okay, great. Thanks. I'm 50. Thanks. It's Hebrew. I know. I don't hear Hebrew very good. This psalm starts off with an address. It starts off, as it were, in the form of a prayer. Moses is talking to Yahweh. He's addressing him. And I want to say to you, I love the way this thing starts. There's lots of different ways a psalm like this, which is so historical and sort of cosmic and broad and deep in its scope, there's lots of different ways this could start. But it starts with this address and says something about refuge and safety, which we'll get to in a moment. But Moses, in addressing God in this psalm does what I think is the most fundamentally important thing that should be true of us, and we can make it a prayer of ours for the next year. Moses strikes one of the most truthful postures men can and must take before God, and it is the posture of prayer. But let me say some things to you about prayer. True, unfeigned, sincere, humble, submissive, patient, waiting, confident but not presumptive conversation with our Maker has to be the fundamental characteristic posture of His people. Sometimes I get asked, for a variety of reasons, why pray? You ever had that question asked you? Being a pastor, I'm supposed to have all those answers. And they're supposed to be deep and profound and ever-changing and suited to everybody's situation. And I have to say that I don't disappoint. Just seeing if you're awake, okay? Just track with me. But I do get asked that question, and I usually get asked that question by people who are either dealing seriously with circumstance in their life that is just unmanageable or not going at all in a direction that maybe they've even been praying about for a long time. Or I get asked that question by people who, as has been in our history, are thinking seriously about sovereignty and immutability. If God does not change, and if my days were written down in His book before the first one came to pass, then what's the point in praying? How could my praying have any effect at all on the sovereign, decreed before time began, will of God? How could I ever even expect to change that? And if God's not changeable, how could my petitions, as earnest as they could be, have any effect on God? That's a legitimate question. That's a good question. But I think it's misdirected. And naturally you would think that of me, wouldn't you? But it is a good question, and one that I've had to think about over the years, and one, frankly, that I have actually changed my answers on. Years ago, I would have given some pretty standard answers that were good ones, and they would not have been wrong, and I don't think they're necessarily wrong now, but I guess I would say I've shifted my focus on that. How is it that a sovereign God can be moved by prayer? How is it that prayer can be effective at all? And I guess I would just say to you that I think fundamentally asking that question that way misunderstands the nature of prayer in some ways. We all know we have been given permission and we have been invited to the throne of God to make our petitions known, right? So asking God for things is a thoroughly biblical theme, and it is a command and an invitation and a privilege for us to pursue. But I would say, and I certainly have come to this conclusion more in my own mind and heart and how I genuinely feel about this, I would say that to think of prayer that way and in those terms is to think of prayer as a tool, to think of prayer as a way to get what I want, perhaps, or a way to change other people, often whom I'm in conflict with or who are not the way I want them to be. Get God on my side and we know that'll fix them. Or prayer may be a tool at my disposal to change my situation, whatever my situation may be. And again, I want to say right up front that I don't think that's wrong. We pray about situations, we pray about people, we pray about ourselves. We pray to God for things that we need, and we've been told by God, by the Father, and by the Son to do those things. But if that's the only way that we think about prayer, we'll miss this fundamental aspect about prayer, and that is prayer fundamentally for us as believers, it is the creature coming into alignment with the Creator. That's what prayer fundamentally is. Prayer is, think of it in these terms, prayer is the radical adjustment that a lifelong blind man makes when he is suddenly made to see. Think about that. It's hard. But think about somebody who never was able to see and all of the ways that life is adjusted to accommodate blindness. It's hard for seeing people to think that way. You know, you can walk, try this at home sometime in familiar territory. Close your eyes and try to navigate. Go try and cook something. Or try and perform some menial task that you do all the time with your eyes open, just to get a sense for how weird and difficult it might be. But think of what the brain does and the body does and the mind does and the hopes and expectations of a person who has been blind for a lifetime and the adjustments that are made in the approach to life. And then think, in terms of Jesus healing a blind person, what it must have been like to have him spit and take mud made with his spit and smear it on the eyes of somebody, and in one instance, have the eyes open gradually. You remember that whole story? It's kind of an enigmatic. Wipes the spit on there. What do you see now? I don't know. Men walking around looking like trees. Okay, spit a little bit more, whatever, and it all becomes clear. If I ever wanted anybody to spit on me, it would be Jesus. You know, other people, not so much. Prayer is the radical adjustment that a lifelong blind man makes when he is suddenly made to see. Prayer is the new stance and the new stride of a man who has been lame all of his life and suddenly has been given the strength to walk. Everybody's been carrying him for his whole life. Up to the temple gates and set by the gate beautiful. Acts chapter 3. You know, when that guy got healed, he didn't kind of slowly back away from the scene and drift away. They couldn't hold him down. He made a ruckus. He embarrassed the dignitaries of the temple because his decorum all out the window. No sophistication. The guy's never been able to walk. He's had to go to the temple steps and sit there and depend on the goodness of other people to give him what he needs to live off of. And you know, people in their generosity get jaded and stingy as time goes on. You see the same thing over and over again. Yeah. Think what kind of adjustment in how that man stood and how he strode and how he carried himself when in a moment his legs got strong. Prayer is the first utterance of a deaf mute who has for the first time had his tongue loosed. Think of John. Just John, is it Zechariah? Zechariah, isn't it? John's dad, when he was struck mute because of his disbelief of the promise that was given to him about Elizabeth and about Mary, struck mute for that short monthly span of time, and when it was time for him to speak, the frustration of not being able to say what he needed to say, but then all of a sudden being able to utter what came from his mind. I tried to pick some analogies to get you to see that prayer is a posture, not simply in the sense that we think it is, which is down on our knees or prostrate or standing with hands folded and eyes closed and those kind of things. We think of prayer sort of punctiliar that way, moments in time. And those, again, are not, they're not in error to think that way. But prayer, in its most basic reality, is us coming into alignment with what we formerly were blind to, uninterested in, unable to see, unable to hear, unable to follow, unable to pursue, unable to care about. Prayer is the answer to all of that. It is all of that being made strong and open and hearable. And prayer is that conversation that is engaged when God comes and does what he does. It's why Paul can say, pray without ceasing. It is not a point in time practice. It's not strictly a matter of mechanics. It is the posture of rescue and reconciliation and peace. And it is why Moses begins this psalm solicitously towards Yahweh and the thing that he is actually praying for. Christians don't pray fundamentally as the employment of a tool, as a way to get things, or even fundamentally as a way to change things. Christians pray because it is what defines them as Christians in some ways. You know, it's one of the reasons, as an example, that we don't, that we're discerning and thinking about our evangelism and leading people in prayers at the end of gospel presentations. The Holy Spirit, when he breathes life into a dead soul, animates the heart and the soul in prayer. He animates that. It's not something that we teach people. It's not something that we do for other people. The nature of regeneration is the connection of a dead soul with life, right? God's never impressed with our wording. He's not impressed necessarily with the content of our prayer. The guy that was in the temple, the publican who stood far off when they went in to offer their gifts and to pray and smote his breast and said, God, be merciful to me, a sinner, whereas the other person went in there and did all that he said. He had a very well-reasoned prayer in saying, I'm glad I'm not like that person. That person's obviously unrighteous. I'm glad I'm not like him. I'm glad that he tipped his hat to God by saying, I'm glad you haven't made me like that or whatever, I don't know. But Jesus said, you see those two people praying? The one who couldn't barely get the phrase out of his mouth, unsophisticated as it was, but as true could be, he was the one who went home justified, right? That's the nature, the trajectory, the course of prayer. It is a defining ontological reality of who we are when we become believers. It's why Moses begins this prayer this way in Psalm 90 as he surveys his whole life and his life with Israel, and he remembers the difficulties and the fact that before God's eyes, both our iniquities and our secret sins, the things that we hide in our hearts, are all on display before God. This is what brings Moses to begin in the posture of prayer. And Moses knows there's only one place of safety. And it's interesting how he juxtaposes mountains, which we think in our experience are the most solid, most unmovable, most grand, magnificent structures on the earth. Even these little bitty Blue Ridge Mountains, which really I'm told by people who've been out west, are not really even mountains. They're foothills compared to the Rockies or the Grand Tetons or whatever. They ain't the Blue Ridge. But even they are grand to scale. You know, the trip up to Sharp Top, the view you get up there, time it takes to get up there, it's just a lovely trip. And there's some majesty to it, isn't there? To get up there and get that grand bird's eye view, to be on the same level as some buzzard or some eagle who's cruising along up at however many hundreds of feet that he's cruising above the trees. It's just an amazing place to be. And Moses knew what they represented and how eternal, as it were, mountains were. And yet he knew that in the dwelling places of men and in the places where men seek refuge and where they seek safety and where they seek permanence, he knew even in the permanence of mountains, even in the unmovable strength of a mountain, there's no safety there. There's no safety there. And so he appeals to God. He appeals to Yahweh by acknowledging that in the affairs of men and in the history of men and in the history of creation and in the, quote, history of God and his from everlasting to everlasting, there's only one safe place in life. There's only one refuge that is unfailing in its provision of safety and refuge, and that, in fact, is in God himself. And isn't that a lovely turn of God's dealing with us, that he sends his Son to be like us so that in baptism and in faith and in confession, we join in union with him and share all of the privileges and all of the love and grace that the Son enjoys is now ours in him. Not ours on our own, but ours in him. It is still true today as it was in Moses' day. There's only one place of refuge, and it is in him. And we seek it everywhere. We seek safety and stability and security in the work of our own hands, don't we? We structure our lives. We want our lives to be a particular way. We live in particular ways. We provide for ourselves, so we think in particular ways, all to give a nice, safe, even, solid floor under our lives. And all God has to do is shake just a little bit. All that seems to just come apart. In fact, the scripture uses that analogy in the day that is coming, the day of the Lord. He's going to shake one more time. And everything that cannot stand and everything that can be shaken is going to be shaken. And everything is going to be leveled, including mountains, which are thought to be immovable. Not in the work of our own hands. And Moses doesn't even give us license to find safety and refuge in the work of his hands. Not even in the work of God's hands, are we to seek safety. Only in him. Only in him. Even the work of his hands are not eternal in that sense. We are to seek refuge and safety in Yahweh himself. And what an invitation. What a privilege. What a joy to be anchored to the only thing, the only one who is eternal. And not to hitch our wagons and our stars to things that are in themselves going to die and perish with the passage of time. Now, so let me just hurry to finish this. The rest of Psalm 90 actually really is from this opening stance, this stance of prayer and this solicitation and appeal to God really to continue to be that dwelling place and to enable the people of God, whoever they may be, to find themselves in the refuge of God. From that opening place, really, the rest of this psalm is sort of a poetic recitation of what Solomon deals with in treatise form in Ecclesiastes. You could probably think, and we won't take the time to trace this out, but the history of Moses, people, Israel, and indeed really all of mankind is really a history of brokenness and sin. That is the truest observation of the history of men. Because of that brokenness and because of that sin, Israel in Moses' day and us in our own day have failed to pursue and align ourselves with the petitions that are given to us in verse 13 through 17. We naturally, by nature, do not align ourselves with the will of heaven. We do not naturally seek the refuge of Yahweh. We would rather fabricate our own safety. We don't naturally pursue those things. So, Moses ends this lament with the hopeful requests that take place in verse 13 through 17. And listen to them and make them the appeals of your own life this particular year, this next 365 days, if God gives them all to us. Here's what we should be asking for. Here's how we align ourselves with the will of heaven. The first place of alignment is found in both the compassion and the mercy of God, which we enjoy now on this side of the cross. And it is always the rock bottom starting place for all of us that we find our satisfaction in the mercy of God. Right? If we ever stray from that, we become discontent, like Israel, who whined and moaned for 40 years in the desert until all the whiners and all the moaners, what? Fertilized the desert floor. Dead at Yahweh's hands. That's the lot of whiners and moaners. That's the lot of those who fail to appreciate the value and to seek to be satisfied in the value of God's mercy. What else could be better than the mercy of God? Can you think of anything? Anything you got for Christmas? Anything you hope to get this next year? Any person you could ever have to know, help, hope to know, or want to be related to? Any job you could have? Any accomplishment? Tell me. Any accomplishment that you can think of, any in all the world that even holds one iota of a candle's light to the mercy of God. Can you think of anything honestly? I know you can't. If you can, you're thinking wrong about the mercy of God. If you can think of anything that even approaches the perimeter of God's mercy as being equal to it or in the same category, you don't understand the mercy of God yet, and you need to understand that mercy. And it is a joy and a privilege and a blessing of God to be satisfied early with God's mercy so that other things don't crowd that out, and so you don't waste your time, as Solomon would say, finding or seeking and trying to find satisfaction somewhere else except at this well. The well of God's mercy is the only place that thirst that you have can be slaked. Satisfy us early with your mercy. And only in that satisfaction, and we'll see this in Solomon's writings, it is only in being satisfied with the mercy of God early in life, early in experience, early, that we may rejoice and be glad all of our days. The setting for rejoicing, the setting for gladness, the setting for satisfaction is this mercy that has come to us at the hands of God. He is the one who can make us glad according to the days in which you have afflicted us, the years in which we have seen evil. Our life is full of evil. Man is born to trouble as sure as sparks fly up in the air, Job said. One of the bitter things that Solomon comments on in his own letter is that he has seen men to whom God has given great riches, but God has withheld something with regard to those riches. You know what it is? The ability to enjoy them. You think about that. How many miserable rich people have you ever known? Almost all of them. There's somebody here in Lynchburg, I was told on the way over here, I won't say who is, just won the lottery, $1 million locally. What? Oh, it was in the paper? Okay. Well, probably most people don't know who he is, but anyway, Marion and I knew who he was. I said, well, I guess it's time to get on his email list. You know, the Proverbs say when you have money, you have friends. And that is true. But when you have money and God doesn't give you the ability to enjoy it and use it the way it's meant to be used, there's no joy, and all it does is put a big old chain on your heart. And you just perish under the weight of that which God gives to you but withholds the ability to enjoy it. And satisfaction with little is way better than discontentment with a lot, to paraphrase Proverbs. You can be happy with anything if you're satisfied with God's mercy, right? You can be happy with anything. In fact, you can say with Job, if he kills me tomorrow or now, it's been good enough. His mercy is satisfactory now, because his mercy will take you into his presence eternally and set you up for the age to come. Satisfy us early. Make us glad with what he's given to us. And I love verse 16 and 17. Let your work appear to your servants. In our own time, it is God's privilege, and he has done this in the Gospels, to make known to us the mystery of his will. And there's a big room of discussion to be had on that. And we've had that many times in our own fellowship. At least I've tried to have that discussion with you from a variety of New Testament texts. But God has let his work appear to us in ways that he didn't even allow it to appear to Moses. We now have been made known. The mystery of his will has been made known to us. The secrets of the kingdom have been revealed to those that God has chosen. And verse 17, at the end of verse 16, let your work appear to your servants and your glory to their children, because it is the glory of God that sustains the next generation to continue on with what the previous generation didn't do as well as it could have. We're always one generation away from throwing the truth to the ground and pursuing our own aims. And the best of us with our children, do what we may, are still utterly dependent upon God showing to our children his beauty and his glory. And it's his beauty and his glory, rightly understood by our children, that will be the motive that carries them on into the next generation. It's not our haranguing. It's not our guilt and our manipulation or all the other kinds of things that we use. It is the glory and the beauty of God that will take them on. It will stoke their desire and their imagination for the things of God. And it is how we live and how we are satisfied early with God's mercy and those kinds of things that our children observe that sets the stage for them to desire and pursue the beauty of God and the glory of God. And we're surrounded by both of those things. And it is up to us in our community together and in our homes and in the way that we work and the ways that we align ourselves with the will of heaven that will set the stage for the generation to come. It will also be the occasion when God will put his beauty upon us and establish the work of our hands. This is the plea of Ecclesiastes again. Not only will God give us the ability to enjoy what he gives to us, but he will make what we do matter. He will make what we do matter. And there's nothing sadder than coming to the end of a life without mattering. And people do that all the time. Lives end that way, even as we breathe right now. Lives are ending without significance. Now, I don't know if that will ultimately be true in God's economy, but in the realm of men and in what is done under the sun, lives perish into nothingness without mattering, it seems, at all in the affairs of men. And we are very adept at flushing years and years and years of time down toilets, so to speak, burying talents as the parable goes, and squandering what God has given to us. But on a high note, we end with these solicitations, with these alignments of the posture of prayer, what prayer really means and how God means to direct us and what he even promises to us in these things that Moses knew that Israel needed to return to and that the people of God even today need to highly esteem and direct their energies and their time and their affections to the pursuit of these things in prayer, in living, in the structure of our lives, in the choices that we make, the things we will and won't do, the ways in which we will structure our lives so that they are available or unavailable to all the right things, to the things that God has in fact called us to. So I just want to encourage you, meditate on this psalm in Ecclesiastes. We'll be there in a couple of weeks, and it's going to rock our world in some ways, I hope, as it is meant to do, and I hope it will realign some of us. Whether we're older or whether we're younger, we constantly need to be realigned. And my prayer is for myself and for you as well, that God in fact will realign us and therefore make us the place where the beauty of God in this time and this place can actually be seen and observed. So let's take a few moments just to be still and think about this before the Lord. You pray, and then I'll conclude in a moment.